Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful, wonderful audience. I'm in a kind of a super mood today. Just tons of things have been going on and happening. The trip to Denmark, which I took with my dear friend Pam Popper, who will be joining us. By the way, are you there yet, Pam? Are you hooked up to the show?
Here. I am here.
Oh, my gosh. You sound clear as a bell. I tell you, you want to get to be good friends, take a long trip back and forth to Europe and do some public speaking together and stuff like that. And we're going to have, I can't talk about all of it, but Pam and I are going to have some really terrific stuff coming out. We not only have my courses that I teach through Pam's company, the Wellness Forum, and we're going to be doing new courses and new activities. So just stay in touch with us and, go to Pam Popper's pages, her website, and sign up for her daily information, which often includes stuff about me, but just has great books and wonderful, wonderful commentary on science and nutrition. Unlike me, Pam just writes and writes and writes about everything new that's going on. So just there's always new stuff on her website. And just keep your eye on us because we are planning all kinds of things to do. And we do have up already, my big course on psychiatric drugs and drug withdrawal. It's really all about psychiatry and just dozens of videos and interactive with a young psychiatrist and also interactive with me a few times. And I'm not sure when the next sign up is. Maybe Pam can tell us. But and then we've got a new course up for that simplifies things on drug withdrawal for the layperson. And then we have the first half up of my course on how to help people, which starts out with how to help yourself. And I wouldn't be doing any of that if Pam hadn't said, listen, I'll manage all this. You just talk. I'll organize it. I'll participate. I'll collect the tuition. You know, I'll handle whatever comes up. I mean, I'm speechless at all the wonderful stuff that Pam does. And sometimes I'll come up with an idea, and I don't have the resources to implement it. And Pam will say, "Let's do it." And we're in the middle of that kind of a place right now. Now, we were going to have Kim Witzak on today, who was with us. I promoted this show as me and Pam and wonderful Kim Witzak, who sits on FDA boards as a consumer rep. But she's had airline complications coming back from the conference. She stayed later, and she is not going to be able to appear with us today. She sends her best to everybody. So it's going to be me and Pam. And you can call in and talk with me and Pam and about the show. We're going to be talking about this big conference in Denmark, as I did publicize. And it's about, truth in science, honesty in science. We're just going to have a good discussion about how bad it is in science today, and It's just overwhelming. It's just overwhelming. I seem to be a bit speechless today about all the excitement. Remember, 888-874-4888 to call in. 888-874-4888. And by the way, if you're listening from somewhere else and have no idea when this show took place and whether it's live or not, today is March 13th, 2019. If you're not listening today, you can't call in. But if you're listening today, you sure can call in. And I'm hoping to get some callers from Europe. I talked to a few people who may be able to call in, but you know, 2 days after a big and successful conference, things are pretty busy and people lose track of what they're doing. So we'll see. And remember, you can listen to this and all my shows on the archives. And remember, you can email me, folks. Get in touch with me with our dedicated line, BreganLive@Hotmail.com. BreganLive@Hotmail.com. And remember, we also have fresh breaking news every day. It's really interesting stuff. My assistant, Ian, is just brilliant. And sometimes I suggest stuff, and Ginger does, but... thank you, Ian, for that wonderful work that you do in keeping things up. So that's about it. You're listening on PRN-FM. If you've got this on your phone and you don't know where it came from or what the connection was, it's www.prnfm is the origin at 4 p.m. New York time every Wednesday. That's my show. That's my really, really long introduction. And I'm just going to throw it all to Pam and let her start talking about the conference. Pam, tell us what your feelings, your impression were, or whatever else you want to talk about. Pam Popper.
Yeah, well, thank you, first of all, for having me on. And I guess what I would say, you know, start with the macro issue, and then maybe we can talk about some of the individual presentations that were made, because they were all pretty awesome. But as I was sitting there, because I didn't speak till like next to last, so I had a chance to really watch everything, and I was thinking to myself, you know, there are two sides of this. One is there the side of the people and the institutions that are so corrupt and awful that you almost can't believe that people can have this much callous disregard for human beings and the harm that their terrible behavior, their unethical practices cause. They just don't care. In the pursuit of money and power and a lot of things, they just don't care. And you and I have been at this for a long time, you for a much longer time than me, and you think you would get to the place where you'd say, oh, I think I'm beyond being shocked. But I still found myself like jaw-dropping when I listened to some of these stories of what happened to people. And then on the other side of the issue, you see these people who, at great inconvenience, financial loss, frightening things going on, just dug in their heels and said, I'm not caving. I'm going to keep at this. I won't let you buy me off. I won't let you destroy me. You see this human fortitude in the face of this kind of thing, and it restores your faith in humanity. And I give some people the amount of credit. We don't pay enough attention to what it takes to stand up to these god-awful people. And so I was real inspired. I mean, there's a part of you that says this is far worse than I thought. But I think the bigger message from the day was how inspirational it all was, and how we should all be inspired to know that doing the right thing brings good things. Sooner or later, it all comes out okay in the end. So that's my macro impression. And then the presentations were spectacular, and the stories behind the information. The information was great. The stories behind the information were just terrific too.
Again, I'm still breathless today. I'm still recovering from the trip. And folks, I've mentioned to you I got a trainer, and I did it partially. No, I did it entirely because Pam was pushing me, saying your next step is to get a trainer. And today I did an hour and a half of exercise. I did half an hour of it as aerobic. And I'm just adjusting to this new and healthy life. Bob Whitaker was there. In fact, I encouraged Bob to come. The symposium, it was called the Symposium About Scientific Freedom. and the Institute's name is the Institute for Scientific Freedom. And it was actually my idea to have the symposium and to have first for Peter Goetze, who was coming under attack, to have a place to go to. Peter Goetze, this great man who wrote the book Deadly Psychiatry, among others, and who is an outstanding member of the great establishment of Europe, has been relieved of all of his duties in every arena, his own institute that he founded, the international group that he founded to monitor medical quality in regard to publications. And so I wanted to inspire him by giving him some good ideas, and that's what he did. He went ahead and he built the conference. I didn't do the work, and he took the name of the Institute for Scientific Freedom, and it made him so happy to see all of this happening, and he felt so inspired. And I talked with Pam along the way. We had a phone call with me and Pam very early on the attack on him, with me and Pam talking to him in Denmark, and she just gave him a lot of encouragement. And then a lot of the people who were at this conference, many of them came from Pam, and many of them came from me. People came from India to see me. They came from all over the world to see me and Pam. So we're getting out there, folks. You're not listening to a lonely radio audience. And, you know, Pam, I think you and I were probably the most enthusiastic people there. Is that partly just because we're Americans and we're more enthusiastic?
Well, I think we've been at it for a long time, as I mentioned. And I think that because what happens when you do this for a long time is you really morph from being aggravated and shocked and persecuted and feeling bad to feeling strong and actually thinking this is great sport. I think that's where you and I are.
Well, at times, so I wouldn't go as far. I'd say that's true, folks, of Pam. It's great sport. For me, it's an obligation and a duty which I'm learning to enjoy in part through Pam.
Well, and that's where it becomes great sport, because the thing of it is, when you have science on your side and you approach this from an intellectual perspective instead of a screaming and hollering perspective, it's amazing. You do win the argument in the end, in a way that is very crystal clear to other people, particularly consumers who are watching. And so I think that we were very enthusiastic about it because we saw this as a way to spread the word more. I think both of us felt delighted and honored that we were invited to be presenters. I know I felt that way. And it was hard not to be excited about the response from the media. There were quite a few media reporters there. The documentary makers were there. So I felt inspired about the whole thing. And I think anytime you connect with other people in the same situation, there's just power in numbers. And I think that through the Institute and some things that you and I are talking about, we need to capitalize on that. We have a lot of people out there fighting battles on their own. And if all the people fighting battles on their own got together and fought battles together, many hands make light work. And the other thing, and I've been thinking about this a lot since we were there, is that it doesn't matter how much money drug companies and medical cartels give to government employees and elected officials. There's one thing that we can do for those people that they can't do, and that is we vote for them. In other words, a state legislator, for example, mandating vaccines, or a state legislator who passes laws mandating institutionalization for mental health patients, they can get all the money they want from the medical associations and the drug companies. But a guy with a rich bank account who loses an election, that's not really where they want to end up. And I think we need to capitalize on that. I'm pretty geared up to want to do that right now. It's been a long time since I worked on those issues, but I'm pretty geared up about it.
Well, that's good, and I'm pretty geared up about it, too. And we're going to have Pam back on not long from now with Maybe some, can I go this far, Pam, and say maybe with a new organization that's going to have a real impact on freedom of information in science here in the United States. Do you want to say anything more, or is that too much already?
I think that's enough for now. I mean, I think the important thing, one of the big things that has haunted movements to try and fix some of this is disorganization and lack of cohesiveness. And I'll tell you, the other side is real disciplined about what they do, and they spend their money, they protect each other, they really think through strategies. They think through strategies of how to engage in criminal behavior and get away with it, and they do. And so, you know, one of my slides at the conference was, I think we need to do what they do. In other words, they're a tight-knit group that marches in step with one another. Now, they may all despise each other when they get behind closed doors, but I'll tell you what the public sees is a united front. You got the government, you got the medical associations, big food, big ag, big drug. You got all these organizations that are working in lockstep with one another, and they get things done because they're highly disciplined and highly organized. And I think we have to counter that with the same type of approach, and keeping in mind that we have to be even more disciplined and more cohesive, because they're a trillion dollars ahead of us in terms of wealth. So that doesn't mean that you can't win. It just means that you've got to outmaneuver and you got to be real strategic about what you do. So I think we'll probably make some announcements when we're in that well thought out strategic type place, and then we'll be asking people to get involved.
You made some interesting comments to me about confronting good and evil when we look at these really fine men. Many of them have been working in this area, no connection to me or you. Some of them about the vaccines, which, folks, I'm learning more about the vaccines, and I didn't want to start criticizing vaccines. I got enough enemies out there, pharmaceutical corporations, the FDA, American Psychiatric Association, and so on and on, because I've successfully hurt them in the name of educating the public, as has Pam. But the story of vaccines, which maybe Pam and I can touch on, she knows much more about it than I do, is just bizarre. And that came up in the research that we heard. And I mean, it is so clear, well, it seems to be clear, at least from what I'm seeing, that some of the vaccines are helpful. But overall, they're shortening lifespan, some of the research shows. And a number of them are doing more harm than good. And it's very hard for me to winnow it all out. And the way the government has protected the vaccines is incredible. Pam, one of the things I learned, and that maybe you knew before, is that if a company develops a vaccine that it can give to a child, then it gets the full protection of the federal government. And the federal government has literally a secret vaccine court, which is the only place you can sue. And you have to go there to the secret court. And then who are you going to face in the secret court? Not a drug company lawyer, which would be bad enough. You're going to face the U.S. Justice Department defending the drug companies in the secret vaccine court. It's mind-blowing. And only rarely does information get out about what the things are that are going on from a number of the different vaccines. I think maybe Pam can address it some more. But they're neurologic. They've been called, that it's been said they're causing autism. They're not. Autism is a psychosocial disorder. It doesn't have neurological findings. These children are developing, and adults, neurological findings, gastrointestinal findings. Some people think that the origin is the neurological finding. I think Pam's good arguments that the fundamental damage is in the gut. But there's a lot going on, and it's kept secret. This means that the drug companies have this amazing opportunity. If they can develop a vaccine, they're guaranteed a profit and protected from loss from the major source of potential loss, which is lawsuits. It's bizarre. So naturally, they're developing vaccines. And if you want to know why, and I think the number's 51, why our children get 51 vaccines, it's because their bodies are a great market. Pam, did I make a mistake in anything I just said?
No, I think it's 57 vaccines by the
kindergarten.
By the time they graduate from high school, it's like 120 some. It might even be more. And one of the reasons is they don't work. And so we keep getting more and more boosters. And I've said, tongue in cheek, one of these days, if we don't do something about this, we're all going to walk around with a drip bag, you know, on a pole, like you do. They'll just drip vaccines into us 24/7. You know, they just don't work. And so, and there's so many aspects of this, you know, all this screaming and hollering about the measles epidemic. And I write articles about this all the time. The current measles epidemic is an incidence of 1 in 3.3 million people. Now, if you were to ask anybody at the CDC, would something be considered an epidemic when the incidence is 1 in 3.3 million, they would laugh at you. But that's actually the language that they're using at the CDC for this. Of course, after some of what I found out from Tom Jefferson about the CDC, it doesn't surprise me at all.
That's in our conference, folks. The reason I'm talking about this is we heard some very strong scientists talking about this subject. Well, you know, you're saying they don't work. I certainly got evidence at this conference that the measles vaccine had increased longevity from many disorders in relatively, you know, undeveloped culture, societies in Africa. And the thought was that the vaccine was actually boosting the immune system in general.
I was
going to ask you. I know you had some different thoughts about that.
Well, the thing of it is, if you take a look at what happened in the United States from before the vaccines came out, most of these diseases that needed to be eradicated were eradicated. I have a lot of thoughts about this, and I'll start with the fact that humans develop resistance to diseases that are fatal. For example, you don't see many people coming down with cholera in the United States, and the reason is because it has no useful purpose. And in fact, the mutation that humans in westernized countries went through to not get cholera is the same mutation that makes some people susceptible to developing cystic fibrosis. Genetic mutation isn't always a perfect thing, you know. So there's always a counter.
So, Pam, it's not public health.
Public health had a lot to do with that. When you stop having feces running in the street and the water is clean,
yeah,
and people are washing their hands when they're performing surgery, I mean, all kinds of things reduce the risk. The stable food, a stable food supply, people having food sufficiency, that all makes a big difference. And so the bottom line is that by the time the polio vaccine was introduced, there was very little polio. Many diseases went away because they serve no useful purpose. I mean, I could find it for you. I wrote an article on this. We now have very clear evidence. This was a long-term study involving a lot of, I mean, huge, ginormous number of people, a huge cohort, that certain childhood diseases, not having them, increases the risk significantly of a child developing leukemia. And so you get less of this and more leukemia. And so these trade-offs are there that people are not really aware of. And anytime you here's just something to keep in mind. You cannot manipulate one thing without having a counter effect on the other side. And sometimes we don't know what that is until we do a lot of this. And then you end up with 2 million vaccine injured kids in the country. And gosh, we never planned for that. Well, that's what happens when you jump off the cliff and you start doing things before you really know what you're doing. So my point in all of this is that if we go to Guinea-Bissau, the anthropologist who gave this talk was spending time in Guinea-Bissau. If we go to Guinea-Bissau and we assume that the only way to improve public health is to give kids inoculations, we're not going to worry about clean water, we're not going to worry about food sufficiency. Well, that's one way to invest a lot of money on behalf of the Gates Foundation. The other thing might be to actually change the public health in the way that it changed here for those people, because you also heard the guy say that that nomadic children who don't get DTP are dying at half the rate of the village kids who are stable, live in the same place, and get DTP. So maybe everything would be okay if we only did measles. I would argue, and somebody in the audience tried to argue, that you could get there without without the vaccine. We did it here in the United States. The year before the vaccine was introduced, 450 children died of measles in a country of, you know, a couple hundred million people at the time, 250 million people. And you don't want to minimize those deaths. But the point that I'm getting at is, if you save 450 kids from dying, and I don't know that we're doing that, but you end up with 2 million kids that get injured, you know, at some point in time you have to say, is this trade-off worth it? I mean, you can't remove all risk in a population. It's impossible to do. You can't do it. So in minimizing the risk in this one way, you're going to cause something else. And the something else appears to be a big problem. I mean, the lifetime cost of caring for one of these kids is a couple million dollars, $2 million per kid.
You're talking about cystic fibrosis kids?
No, I'm talking about kids. I'm talking about autism. I'm talking about the vaccine-injured kids who have whatever you want to call it.
I mean, that's not really autism, as we've discussed.
I know, but here's the thing.
It's called autism.
99.999999% of people are calling it autism, and so the only thing that I don't want to do is have a lot of angry people thinking that you are not acknowledging what's wrong with these kids, because that's what they're calling it, that's what they're treating it, and it may be that there's a different definition of autism, but these kids are demonstrating behaviors that appear to be. I agree with you that it's not the same the definition that you would find in a psychiatry manual, but the
Take a deep breath. Let me ask a couple of questions. First of all, let me explain my view of the autism issue, because I think it's important, because I think it's very misleading to call it autism. It would be like calling it schizophrenia, which is not a disease, that they're getting schizophrenia from these vaccines, and they're not. And what they're getting, folks, from these vaccines, some of them, and Pam can talk more about that than I can, is they're getting neurological harm. And when you harm neurologically a young person, they will have more difficulty relating to people. They'll have delayed speech. They'll have all kinds of different things. But it's not a psychosocial disorder. It is a known neurological disorder caused by these drugs. And in fact, these kids would not end up necessarily, if we were sane, seeing anybody that, you know, was going to call it a psychiatric disorder. Let's say go to a neurologist, go to some new specialist in the area, and so on. So I think it's an important issue. And I wanted to try to clarify a couple of things that Pam is saying, because they confuse me a little. And she is probably the smartest person I know. I don't know whether it's Pam or Ginger, my wife, but Pam has more information than Ginger does about these things. So being the smartest person I know, two things. One, I want to ask you about. I think what you're saying is that one of the unanticipated outcomes, which is a really good concept, the unanticipated outcome, is that if you're not having the child's immune system stimulated by the natural stimulants in the environment, many of which have existed, I'm sure, for millions of years, that there's things are going to change in the immune system that may make the child perhaps unable to control leukemia or other diseases. Isn't that one of the thoughts? Am I clear on that?
Yeah. In other words, my point in talking about cholera is that we seem to get rid of diseases that don't serve a useful purpose for humans, and the reason why measles has persisted is that it serves a useful purpose for humans, or we would have become immune to getting it, because that's what humans and other beings do. They evolve to, they adapt to the environment in order to survive. So it's kind of hard to fathom how we could have adapted to the environment to get rid of some of these diseases, and measles has hung around for all this time. That doesn't mean that children don't die of measles. They do. And I don't want to minimize the children who do. That's a terrible thing. But, you know, you cannot, it is impossible for any public health organization to eliminate all risk, and that appears to be what the game plan is right now. In an attempt to eliminate all risk of children getting anything that could possibly hurt them in any way, shape, or form, for every kid that we're saving, you know, you got 450 deaths from measles the year before the vaccine comes out, you're injuring multiples more in a different sort of way. And the thing that makes it so unpalatable to the parents is that it's medically induced, not organically induced. You know, it's one thing if your kid gets sick and something bad happens. It's another thing when the medical profession and the CDC and the FDA make the child sick and something bad happens.
Folks, this is so important. You actually answered my second question about when you were saying that these things die off because they're not useful. What you're saying is we develop immunities to them, mm-hmm. because they're not serving a purpose while they're making us sick. But that measles, and there was such an interesting discussion of that by one of the scientists at the Institute that we just came back from in Denmark, which I had not thought about, was how possibly disorders like measles are producing effects that that are developing our immunity and strengthening our bodies. I remember, and this is from, decades ago, and by the way, folks, can you imagine hearing this on any other radio station? I mean, you could hear people screaming about these things, but where are you going to get an expert like Pam Popper to have a discussion with another rational scientist, me, hopefully, about these kinds of issues and to talk about it rationally and to try to explore it? I have never heard a conversation like this. Maybe some of you had someplace or another. And God knows what kind of increased attack there will be on my work as a result of finally opening this subject up to to these kind of questions. Pam, I remember learning somewhere, maybe way back in med school, I'm not sure where, that sickle cell anemia could be an example of a protective disease. And sickle cell anemia, which is a form of anemia that distorts the shape of red blood cells and is prominent among people who live in Africa, the Africans, and has been there for a long time, is protective against malaria. Is that so?
I don't know, but it's interesting that you should bring it up, because people are always writing me and asking me to create content based on that and on various topics, and that's one that I've received a lot. So I don't know if you know this. I teach this really good research and writing class, and the class trains people to think like you and I do. And some of the papers that the students end up writing are pretty phenomenal. In fact, I put them in the newsletter. I could not write something better, and that's saying a lot because I'm pretty good at this. But I've put that on the topic of things that we're going to research together this year. So we'll come out with a really good group-written 50 people working on it paper on that topic, and you can have me back on, and we'll talk about it.
Well, good. Well, good. Any more thoughts about this whole business with all the needles we're giving our kids? It's it came up a number of times during the conference, and interestingly enough, I don't think there was a single presenter in this arena who was against all all of the vaccines. I mean, not even close to that. These were pretty conservative scientists. They looked conservative. By conservative, I don't mean politically conservative, because they're not. I mean, you know, thoughtful, just, you know, people, be cautious people. Mm-hmm. So none of them was taking a broad, as I recall, at all, condemnation of the vaccines. They were speaking about that, you know, as many, too many, and most of them were not helpful. Some of them were helpful, and some of them were increasing the overall longevity. Is that a fair description of what we heard?
Yes, and there's one thing that I'll add to it that I think is really important, and that was that Dr. Gertz has said on a couple of occasions that he does not like the mandate. He basically talked about the flu vaccine. Of course, that one's useless for everybody, but he talked
about
the flu
vaccine. There was general agreement, folks, that the flu vaccine is dangerous and useless.
Right, and then there was general agreement that it should be up to parents. This idea of mandating is not a good idea. And Dr. Gertz said that in reference to the childhood vaccines. And the one thing that's always puzzled me, and nobody's ever been able to explain it to me, is I've never understood how my not vaccinated child can harm your vaccinated child if the vaccines work. So what is the hysteria about? If you have a school, and let's just say for argument's sake, there are 500 children in the school, and 47 parents decide we're not going to vaccinate our kids. So you got 47 unvaccinated kids in a school of 500 children. It seems to me that the 553 vaccine kids would have nothing to worry about. Right?
I never heard this argument before until you brought it up on our long airplane trip or somewhere in the last few days.
Nobody ever has an explanation. When you bring that up, the response is screaming and hollering and you're an anti-vaxxer. And I'll tell you something, this is an issue. It's a big issue. What we have I'm going to back up and say something because I think this is important. When most people start approaching healthcare with a more skeptical eye, you're coming at it for psychiatric drugs, and somebody else like Dr. Esselstyn at Cleveland Clinic is saying, my gosh, is bypass surgery and angioplasty the mastectomy of the 21st century, because his father-in-law was involved in reducing the use of the Hegstead procedure. And so everybody thinks it's just their area, especially, and then you come to these conferences and you find out that all branches of medicine, all of them, are terrible, right? They're all doing the same terrible thing. So I think that's the first thing that we need to get out there, is I think there's you tend to think that it's just one issue, and then you find out it's all issues. So wouldn't it be a great idea if we could just stop screaming and recognize that since everything else seems to be so screwed up, are we really, mathematically, it's almost impossible that the vaccine program could be safe and effective when nothing else you and I have looked at in medicine is safe and effective for everybody right now? Nothing. Not a single thing. Can you think of a branch of medicine where everything that goes on there is just great right now? I can't.
No, but what comes up, which is interesting, is that there is a sense that the emergency procedures are sometimes helpful.
Absolutely.
And some of the techniques and you were the first one I heard talk about this, that some of the emergency surgical techniques, the life support emergency stuff, that what we have grown good at is emergency stuff in extreme cases. And
right.
Then we generalize it all over the place. For example, the drugs for cholesterol, I mean, they basically, and then I think we should talk a little more about that, they basically were developed on the basis of people with cholesterol levels like 500, that if you take apart the studies and you don't have a cholesterol level of 500 or so, you know, they're not going to help you. And similarly, that there are drugs that might help you temporarily in an emergency room, but they're really not going to help you long term. One of the reasons is the human body is not built to receive and to change in response to surgeries. Believe it or not, that's not what we are. You know, we're developed to handle wounds and stuff, but not the major heart surgery. We didn't develop to be able to take psychogenic drugs, drugs that impaired brain function and live with them for 5 or 10 years. So it's more the emergency procedures. Everywhere else I'm looking, what happens is that doesn't make enough money for the drug companies. The drug companies and other marketing companies that are marketing stuff, they all want something you have to take forever. I mean, I've literally talked to people in the industry in diabetes, for example, and they don't want to develop a cure like Pam's plant-based diet. They're just not into it because it won't make money. They literally want a drug you have to take forever. It's policy of a company to look in that direction. So what am I? I think I'm sort of on the right track in some of this, especially about this. I don't mean most of this. Most of this is just the same everywhere. But the emergency stuff is sometimes useful.
Right. We don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But coming back to a point that I think is really important, and what you're saying is true. There's usefulness for this stuff, but we're overusing it. So you get to this vaccine issue, and the first thing is what we're supposed to do is essentially you and I are supposed to say to ourselves, if we listen to these people, every other branch of medicine is all screwed up. I mean, it just practice after practice after practice, not supposed to do it, overusing it, misbehavior, I mean, whatever you want to talk about. Except for vaccines, we got that all right. Okay,
We
got perfect. And that justifies logic. But the other thing, and I think that this goes to how the pro-vaccine, I don't know what you want to call them, vaccine advocates, how off-putting they are, is that the only weapon they seem to have is screaming at the top of their lungs, name-calling, censorship, passing laws to force people to comply. In other words, the way that you win any argument in a country like the United States of America, where we're theoretically supposed to be a free people, is you convince people that what you want to do is a good idea. And that's the basis for which we vote for people. That's the basis by which laws get passed, if enough pressure is brought to bear by the population and that sort of thing. So I think that the other side is showing its lack of ability to convince based on science by the very fact that the only way they can respond to this is screaming, hollering, buying the media, discrediting, name-calling, force, almost military in its nature. Think about if you applied that to some other branch of medicine. What if we did that to people with high cholesterol? Like we told them, if you don't take a statin drug, we're going to come to your house and force you to take it. We won't let you know. If you did this in any other thing, people would just think you were insane. So anyway, I would like to see reasonableness, and you're right. This type of reasonable discussion is not going on anyplace else. If you show up at a conference that's talking about vaccines and you've got pro-vaccine people there and you say, listen, I just have some interesting questions, like the one I posed, how's my not-vaccinated kid a threat to your kid if the vaccine works? And they'll say, you're an anti-vaxxer, you're hurting public, the screaming starts. That's how the questions get answered. And then they wonder.
Pam, I do have, I think, what their reaction might be. They might say, then nobody will be taking them and we'll have to start all over again. There's this fear they'll lose control entirely over what's happening.
Well,
and in a way,
anyway,
they're right that if people knew, if they knew about the vaccine court, if they knew that the reason there was so many, many numbers of vaccinations being given because they couldn't be sued if they for any vaccination they give to children, so maybe there's a note of terror in there that they're sensing that this whole thing could cave in. It's kind of like when I come out as the lone physician who isn't going to treat people with psychiatric drugs, although I have all this experience taking them off. One of the questions they always ask me you know, from the establishment, and they ask me anxiously sometimes when I come off the plane, and they'll say, well, wouldn't you give the drugs to somebody? And I say, why are you so interested in that? What if I said I gave them to one kind of person? Well, they can't answer. But what it is that if I could get away with it, if I could be a psychiatrist who can live without giving drugs, then the whole thing's going to collapse. And I think maybe that's a part of the hysteria about the few people not doing it. It's like the whole system will collapse. But still, your point is extremely important, this, because there's no acute danger to those people who are being vaccinated. The acute danger is to the pharmaceutical industry and the government and the medical societies, all of whom get power and money from enforcing the system. They can't allow a crack. They need a Berlin Wall. And they've got Berlin walls, and maybe they'll come down.
Well, I've always said that, but going back to something I said earlier, the drug companies and the medical cartel, if you want to call it that, they can give an enormous amount of money to a politician. But if the politician can't get people to vote for him or her, having a big bank account and being out of office is not where they want to end up. And I really feel that mobilizing people. It's been done before in the United States. A very unpopular law passed in 1994 because of that. Because for the first time in a long time, members of Congress thought, my gosh, if I don't vote for this, they might not let me come back next session, and they can't stand the thought of being out of office, you know. So we're just not organized. We're not going about
that. And also of losing their funding, because they're all funded by the bad guys. All the big lobbying groups are basically bad guys who can't make it just selling to the public or just talking to the public. I'd never thought of it that way. But lobbying groups tend to be the bad guys. They got the power, the money. They don't have a lot to offer. You go to Congress and control things.
Right. Well, they control the Congress, but they cannot deliver votes. And so that's what we can do, is deliver votes. And all you'd have to do, you don't have to vote very many people out of office. You have to take out five or six, if you're looking at Congress in Washington, I think you take out five or six key people. And you do it so that, you structure it so that everybody knows that if we were doing it, we're the people who did it. And then you can say, we're coming after you. Unless you start dancing to our tune, which means that all these mandate laws are not going to happen. The same thing would be true in a state like California. I get calls every day from people in California that are apoplectic about this this issue. And because in California, you have to have all the shots or you can't enroll your kid in school. And they took a very prominent doctor, went after him, and he's working under supervision right now because he was giving parents exemptions. So now you can't get an exemption from anybody because, you know, how we talked about this at the conference. You go after the high-profile people because then everybody else will say, oh, my gosh, I can't let that happen to me, so I'll certainly do what I'm told from this point forward.
Yeah.
Well, all you'd have to do is take out three or four senators in the California legislature and make sure that the folks on our side get credit for it. And the rest of them would come right around because, like I said, there's only one thing that politicians love more than money, and that's holding on to their office. And if they think that they're not going to be able to hold on to their office, they'll do anything. They'll even represent their constituents, as radical as that sounds, if that's what it takes to stay in office. Under normal circumstances, they won't do that. But if they're threatened enough, if they feel threatened enough, they will even represent the interests of their constituents if they have to.
I think that's a really good way to put it. You made passing reference to something that was very important at the conference, and that is that every time somebody pops up in a new area critical of anything in medicine, in applied science, I mean, science really isn't the issue with drug companies and so on. There's no science there at all. It's all BS. It's applied science in the interest of sales. By the way, I no longer think as I did, and this is partly the influence of the conference, you know, that the controlled clinical trial is the gold standard for science in the areas of medicine. No, it isn't at all. It's the gold standard for the drug companies, who convince people that you can take these narrow issues of what causes heart disease or what's causing emotional distress or what's causing diabetes, frame them in a way that excludes exercise, diet, happiness, and all the other multiple factors that contribute to illness and also help overcome illness. So you eat properly, you exercise, you get into a spiritual state that encourages health in your body, and so on. That the love of the clinical trial is the love of people for a narrow interpretation of life that excludes everything except a product. And I've never said it this clearly before in my entire life. And this comes from talking with Pam. Let me know if you think, write to me at breganlive.com. Let me know if you think this conversation is as amazing and important as I do, because I learned so much from talking to Pam and so much from having you there listening, which inspires me to be more direct and more in, just to make, raise more issues with Pam. And I just think this is such a rare opportunity. You just let me know if you think it is too. And what a blessing in my life to be able to have you in it, Pam Popper. That's who we're talking to, folks. Pam Popper, P-O-P-P-E-R. And to have these kind of conversations, because you bring not only your intellect, but so much information to them. And folks, it's mostly because of Pam that I'm branching out into look, and her conferences that I'm branching out. Because my first encounter and my first realization of all of these industries, including all of them taking advantage of children, it's not just the video people and the sellers of violence and sex to children that are taking advantage of them. It's the people who are selling them junk food. And it's the people who are pushing on them against their will or whatever. All of these 57 vaccines and over 100 before they grow up with never any, they never get tested as a bunch. And they barely get tested as as individual vaccines in any satisfactory way. I just remembered something else Pam talked about. I want her to get a chance to talk about, Pam. You were talking about how certain vaccines are promoted without any real testing or any of the promoters having any knowledge of any of the testing. I think you were citing the flu vaccine when we were talking, or is it another one?
Well, the vaccine, the misbehavior in the vaccine trials is that many of these vaccines are damaging, and it's due to the adjuvants. And if you put the adjuvant in the placebo, then you get the same. So that's what Dr. Gertrude found out about the HPV vaccine. They put aluminum as a neurotoxin. So you put it in the vaccine as an adjuvant. You give aluminum in the placebo to the other group. So you get the same amount of neurological damage in both groups, and you pronounce that there's no difference between the groups. So that's the misbehavior. What you're referring to is...
Listen to that, folks. Where else are you going to hear it? But let me know. Let me know if this more broad science, if this conversation with Pam Popper brings up as much for you about this world as it does for me. Pam believes in love. We're not going to let go of love in any of our work, of reaching out, of caring. But here's this dark side, and this kind of level of explanation about it doesn't exist anywhere else. So, all right, and the other thing that it keyed off that you want to talk about?
Well, I want to mention something about love and what this does have to do with mental health, because it's all related. And So we had a employee here for a long time that we just loved this woman. Trained as an attorney and then was a stay-at-home mom, and she had a child who was vaccine injured, and eventually had to leave because there's very spotty assistance with taking care of these children, which have to be watched after. You know, you can have a 12 or 13 year old child, can't leave her alone for very long because they can't care for themselves. It's lifetime care. This is a life sentence that you get signed up for. Well, my point in this is that I'll never forget the day that she told me what happened, and she said that she had taken her child in, and it's been a long time since this conversation, so I don't remember the specific vaccines, but she took her child in and to the pediatrician for a well child check, and got one of the combination vaccines, and the child had so many problems. I mean, screamed and wailed and grabbed her belly, and just had a horrible, horrible time. So bad that she called the pediatrician's office, and they said, "Well, we don't think it has anything to do with the vaccine, but thanks for letting us know. It's probably just some kind of flu bug, and it'll go away." Well, it eventually did, but very extreme gastrointestinal distress. And when a little child screams 24/7 for 4 days in a row, you know something awful is going on. So she brings the baby, the child, back for another well baby visit a few months later, well child visit. I can't remember what age this happened. I think she might have been 2 years old when it happened. But anyway, allows the second shot, the second combination shot. And she said, "I watched my child slip away in the car on the way home. And then here's what we have." So she's high-functioning Asperger's, but still, you know, we get tied up in these terms. But for all intents and purposes, the way that it's labeled in the field right now is autism. So my point in all of this is that she said, I should have known. I should never have let this happen. Well, you and I both know what feeling guilty about something for 12 years can do for a person. Usually doesn't lead to anything good. And so this does have a mental health component, because the parents who are dealing with these children, it is a life sentence. These kids will never be independent, most of them. They are not going to get married and have children and live happily ever after and go off to college and play soccer, and that all that's gone. And then the tremendous guilt, I didn't look into it, I should have known after the first episode. I hear this all the time. And so, you know, this kind of goes along with something that you and I have talked about a lot, which is we decided 24 years ago that you can't be a reductionist. In other words, you just can't deal with people and say, "Hey, I want to help you with your diet. All this other stuff that's going on with you, good luck with that. Let me know how it turns out. I'm just going to do this." It's becoming increasingly hard to focus on a single aspect of somebody's mental, physical health, because they are also interrelated. So I don't think it's so far off topic when it comes right down to it.
No, it isn't at all. And someday, folks, you're going to get a book from me and Pam about the mind and the body, the spirit and the physiology, or something along those lines, one of these days. But right now we're doing so much with the courses that I teach, for example, with her. Please keep track of those courses on Bregan.com. And I didn't mention earlier, for those of you who don't know well who I am, the best way to keep track of me, Peter Bregan, Breggin, is by going to Bregan.com and then sign up for the free frequent alerts. We have thousands of people listening, not listening to, but going to those frequent alerts. And then also YouTube, hundreds of thousands of people. Bregan YouTube channel. Pam Popper, my dear friend, thank you for being on the show again. Thanks for keeping me company back and forth and helping me understand what was going on in Denmark. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was fun.
This was fun. You make it fun for me, Pam Popper. Bye-bye, folks. Bye-bye. Thanks for being that great audience you are. Thank you.